Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome everybody to the Yaron and Amy show. We haven't done one of these in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So gone are the days when we do it every single week. Now that we're doing it in the middle of the week, it's just hard to schedule.
Based on your schedule, yeah.
I'm traveling all the time.
So I'm going to make you work pretty hard today because, as I told you a little bit before the show, I have a dog who's in her days.
Yeah, that's sad. Sad.
So, yeah, I just
the dog that nipped me in
my...
Austin. That's my memory.
She herded you. Come
she
on.
She herded me. She herded
little,
me.
A little herding breed dog, I think, nipped him at the ankle once.
Yeah,
or
she
something.
Nipped me at the ankle
she
in Austin,
me.
Texas. I'm traumatized to this day. I'm traumatized.
Great dog.
Yeah,
really,
great dog.
Really awesome dog. So, yeah. Yeah, she's 16, so it's not unexpected,
no,
but it still hits
time.
You hard. So
yeah, she was a baby when she nipped me. Just that was probably 15 years ago, 16 years ago. So she was a baby.
I did so much training with her to make her grow out of the herding behavior. You know, she's very nice to people now, but yeah. Anyway, so that was my sobering afternoon. Of course, we have a very sobering topic to talk about today as well, which is Pittsburgh. I noticed that you put it off until having a show with me to discuss it, but that's
well,
probably
I was idea. I was
yeah.
I was wondering whether I should do like a newsy show on Sunday or whether I should go on for this nationalism, spend a little bit more time, dig a little deeper into it. And I decided I didn't have any time this week to really dig into the nationalism thing. So I figured I'd do that, and then we would do the more newsy items. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff I haven't talked about the guy who sent the bombs in the mail.
I was going to ask you whether that was even worth, because they didn't go off. It's weird. I'm not understanding.
Well,
I mean,
but it's all part of a culture here of hatred and of the other side, of tribalism, of violence, which I think American political system is moving into that phase. We're seeing on the left and on the right, and so many people keep telling me, oh, you know, the left is the battle and they have Antifa, the right never killed anybody. And really, that's kind of a joke when you think about the murders in that church in Charleston, the stabbing of two people on a bus, I think, or was it on the light rail in Portland, Oregon, because this guy was mistreating a Muslim woman and they stood up to defend her a little bit and he stabbed them. I mean, there's so much violence from the right. Indeed, the violence from the right tends to be a lot deadlier than the violence from the left. But both are violent, and I think all of these are signs of the deterioration, the dramatic deterioration in the culture, the dramatic deterioration of political culture. The fact that we now associate ourselves with political tribes, we had all kinds of tribes.
What about the Las Vegas shooting, too? That's another thing that somebody was.
Well,
what
we
do
don't
we
know.
Know.
We
about
still
that?
Don't know what caused it. We still don't know what was going on, why he did it. We still, as far as I know, there's still no evidence that it was politically motivated. Yes, it was country music, so everybody says he was a lefty trying to kill a bunch of conservatives. There's no, as far as I know, there's no evidence of that. So it's really bizarre that they have come up with nothing with regard to the Las Vegas shooting. But you know, whether, you know, we've had violence from Muslims, we've had violence, you know, Islamic terrorism, but now we're seeing more and more and more kind of an acceleration of violence between Americans, between left and right. You know, Charlottesville, of course. So, you know, you've got more and more and more of this, and it's scary. And, you know, and I think, and we can, you know, we should talk about this. I think the caravan, the way the caravan is being treated, the way people are talking about it, the comments online about let's just shoot them all, Trump's, you know, sending troops to the border, the whole panic
5,200 last I read.
Well,
I
panic
think.
And hysteria about this. This is an annual thing. There's a caravan every year. It's something this leftist organization does every year. But the panic, the hysteria, the just the I mean, politics as pure emotion and pure hysteria and pure panic and vilification, both sides vilifying the other. You know, Trump is Hitler and the left Stalin, and it's those are the options we have, and that's how they present each other to each other. And while both are bad, you know, look at the guy who you know, again, we'll talk about this. I think the guy who shot the synagogue up in Pittsburgh was motivated partially by these refugees.
Yeah, we can revert to
the
language
about
scumbag. This is the latest scumbag. Yeah.
I mean, refugees and the caravan was part of his motivation, and there is a consequence. And we've been talking about this a lot since the election. Really, the emotionalism of Trump, the sheer pragmatism, the lack of any ideology, the lack of reference to any kind of founding principles, but the key is the pure emotionalism of this administration. The attacks on the media, which are, you can attack the media, but over the top, absurd,
well,
nutty.
Well, and you say they're the enemy of the people.
Yes, the enemy,
right?
Of the people. So if they're the enemy,
and then,
shoot
and then,
them.
And then the other day I saw he was correcting his tweet, or he was saying, well, it's the fake news media that's the enemy of the people. But then who's the arbiter of who's the fake news? Whoever he says is fake news. So whoever he deems to be fake news is now the enemy of the people. Enemy of the people is really strong language.
Absolutely.
The question I have for you, right? So I agree, you know, the pragmatism and the stirring up of emotionism, getting people to react based on
anything.
Fear,
yeah.
All the
fear,
time. There,
right.
You know, all of these things are just
right.
Imminent dangers.
Yep.
Catastrophic dangers to us, right?
Well, it goes back to the campaign, right? And I've said this many times. He ran on a three-prong principle, and this links up to anti-Semitism. And people are saying, oh, Trump had nothing to do with it. But yes, the atmosphere created, and we'll get to conspiracy theories because I think that's the other part of,
right.
of
that's
the atmosphere.
The article I have, yeah.
And again, the emotionalism we're talking about. But he ran on a three-prong campaign, and the three prongs were, you know, America is in deep, deep, deep trouble. Things are horrible. Was it carnage in the streets of America? We live in the safest period in all of American history, at least since the 50s. And it's carnage in the streets of America. You know, factories are closing left and right. We produce more than in any point in American history. Yet there's no manufacturing going in America, and on and on it goes. But so the world is ending. The world is horrible. The world is terrible. Who's to blame? And this is the key, right? Who's to blame? The other is to blame. The other. Now, who is the other? Well, in Donald Trump's vocabulary, the other is the Chinese, the Mexicans, the Hispanics, the you know, even the Europeans and the Canadians, depends on his mood, right? Or the North Koreans and the Japanese. But it's the other. Now, in all of human history, the who's to blame the other has been the Jew, right? So again, you're creating this atmosphere of looking for the people who are causing the decline of America. It's not us, right? Donald Trump said it's not us. We're good guys. It's the other inflicting it on us. And by doing that, he is setting people's minds to look. Now, he never said it's the Jew. He would never say that.
No,
and I don't
no.
think
and
he
this
personally.
Is one point, you know, that I want to make, because I put that conspiracy article,
yeah,
I posted
yeah.
it, and I excerpted carefully. The first sentence talks about that Trump's contribution is in fueling a conspiracy mentality in people. It's that's a paraphrase, but, you know, I can give you the exact sentence, right? It's not that he is anti-Semitic.
No,
he's not.
I don't think he is.
And he would not. I mean, if anything, what? He's been, you know, moving the embassy to Jerusalem.
Yeah,
and,
but all of it's pragmatism, right? So I don't think he moves the embassy to Jerusalem because he loves Jews. I think he moved to the embassy for Jerusalem because he could score substantial political points and he rallies his supporters behind it. I don't think Donald Trump's ideological. I don't think he's anti-Semitic. I don't think he's anti-Semitism. I just don't think he's anything. He is what the moment demands him to be. He's got a son-in-law who's Jewish, but I think he probably has in his head a bunch of stereotypes about Jews that in part of his locker room language, I'm sure, includes some horrible things that he might say, not just about women, but about different minorities. And I think he's got that kind of a mind. I know Wall Street people who talk like this. But I don't think he thinks about it, because I don't think he thinks much. But it really is. But again, it's not that he's an anti-Semite. He doesn't have to be an anti-Semite. The point is that by setting the world up as us against them, the other, who is us? And then it's up to his supporters to define who is us. And many of them, not most, maybe not even many, maybe a small minority, I don't know. But some of them define the other as including the Jews. It's not just, you know, in their minds, this is not me saying this, in their minds, oh, the Mexicans, the Chinese, they're too stupid to actually pull all this together. The real conspirators, the real evil lies in the Jews who are manipulating it all in the background. And look, I've been getting this. I mean, all you have to do is look at my YouTube feed on any given show that I do and to see the anti-Semitism that is spewed in my YouTube feed. And I don't have millions of followers. There are not a lot of people on my YouTube feed. So, wow, I mean, even if I'm getting that. And then when I did that show, what, 2-3 years ago about the alt-right? Oh, my God. I've never seen anything like it. The anti-Semitic Twitter posts that I got.
I get some of it just because I kept Leonard's last name, you know, because I've published under it. And so I get a little of it. But, boy, yeah I've seen some of yours. I've seen it.
Unbelievable. So it's alive and well. It's somebody says here it's alive. It's in Latin America. Yeah, it's alive and well in Latin America. It's certainly alive and well in the Muslim world. It's very much alive and well, interestingly enough, in Eastern Europe. You know, so probably not so much in Asia, but outside of there, anti-Semitism is an ancient, deep conspiracy theory that at a time of emotion and of fear, people, you know, are looking for explanations. They're looking for why things are happening the way they are happening. And the explanation that they, you know, the explanation that they easily get or that comes from history
is the
Jews
too,
are responsible.
So when I posted, there's an article, by the way, if people want to look at program notes, they're at my blog at don'tletitgo.com. And the first article is something that I saw in Washington Post. The headline is, Trump doesn't understand how anti-Semitism works, neither do most Americans. And the point of the article was to show that anti-Semitism is not something that's been in the past and is not alive and well now. Like somehow Trump had thought that this is some sort of remnant of the past not a real factor.
Well,
now.
But that's – give me a break. So I have to comment on that because that's absurd, right?
Okay.
And he says it in the article and he's absolutely right, right? Charlottesville, right? And Trump saw the video from Charlottesville where they're walking around with torches, blood and soil.
But he was in Ohio, wasn't he?
What's that?
That or somehow he tried to evade that or
yeah I mean he's completely evading that, right? How can it be a thing of the past when all these guys who he said there were good guys among them, he said there were nice people there, I mean these are people who are marching blood and soil and we won't let the Jews take over,
replace us.
We don't let the Jews replace us. So no anti-Semitism was all over Charlottesville was an anti-Semitic rally among many other things, among many other racist things. And for him to say, to know that, because he saw the video like everybody else, and then to say there were some nice people among them, yeah, some of my best friends are Jews. I mean, it's just horrible. And again, I don't think he's anti-Semitic. I don't think he's anything. But he clearly, by doing that, has sanctioned it. And he can't claim ignorance. He can't claim that this is something of the past. He's just lived it in the last, you know, in the last year.
Yeah. So then the article talked about how he has fed into the conspiracy style thinking, which has been part and parcel to anti-Semitism for a couple of millennia, basically, that there's this conspiracy among Jews to do all sorts of harm or take over the world or replace people or however you want to put it. And it's rooted in, and they talk about this in the article, rooted in the New Testament. So what's interesting, if people are very interested in this, you can go on my thread on my Facebook page. It's a public thread under this article. And James Valiant and a couple other people talk about the New Testament and the support in the New Testament for the idea that the Jews killed Jesus, and so therefore that they were bad, and it started the whole hatred against the Jews, that, you know, the Jews were essentially up to evil. In the New Testament, that there's this evidence there, and that has been carried down through almost two millennia. Finally, it was explicitly repudiated by the Pope, I guess, in the 60s. I got this education the other day. But it had to be repudiated. Why? Because it had either been, you know, clearly in New Testament, or at least clear enough in the New Testament such that that was the predominant interpretation of it.
Sure. I mean, the
millennia.
Jews killed Jesus, and that went through. And it was, and for a long time, Jews were accused of that. I mean, you've got Gavin on my YouTube channel right now. I mean, unbelievably anti-Semitic expressions that he is making. I mean,
I have a dog dying. I want to like flip him off or something.
Yeah, I mean, anyway. I mean, they're all the time. But look, it's not just that, right? It's the Jews of being, the Jews were the, and I have a whole, by the way, I have a lecture that I just put up on YouTube called Anti-Capitalism and Anti-Semitism, where I link anti-capitalism and anti-Semitism. Marx was, in spite of being Jewish, was a real anti-Semite. And it's fascinating to see the anti-Semitism on the left, not just on the right, but the anti-Semitism of all those who are anti-capitalist have always been anti-Semitic from. And that includes not just the Catholics, but also Calvin and I was going to say Calvin and Hobbes, but Calvin and the Protestant, the guy who started the Protestants, Calvin.
Is that Luther?
Luther, Calvin and Luther.
Okay.
I mean, the anti-Semitism.
My religious education is worse than yours.
The anti-Semitism is deep. But it's more than that. As I say in that talk, and then I also talk about in my essay on usury, It is the fact that Jews were moneylenders, and moneylending was viewed as an evil activity. It was in the seventh rung of hell, according to Dante and many of the thinkers of the Dark Ages, and the Jews were doing it. And the Jews are successful at it. And the Jews got rich out of a mortal sin, a sin that sent you to hell, a sin that put you in the seventh rung of hell, and yet they were making money off it and living the good life. And the hatred for the Jews because of that, because they were the financiers. And then the people in power had an incentive to elicit that hatred. It was partially a good way to get rid of their debts. So the Jews of York in England were basically wiped out because the local aristocrat wanted to get rid of his debts. So the best way to get rid of your debts is to kill the person you owe the money to. First thing was burnt when they killed the Jews there. Were the records of who owed whom what. Same thing has happened all over Europe where whole communities were slaughtered in the name of, really motivated by princes who owed too much money. Jews are being banned. I mean, people don't know this, but for 200 years, there were no Jews in England. So Queen Elizabeth, I think it's Queen Elizabeth, you know, kicks out all the Jews. And again, part of the problem is that the kings owed a lot of money to the Jews. They used to, how did they finance the wars? They would go to the moneylender and borrow money, and then they, you know, they hated the idea of paying back. So this went on and on and on for 2,000 years. They killed Jesus, and then they're successful. They're different. They segregate themselves. They're just easy prey for demagogues like Donald Trump. To say, you're great, but everything bad that's happening to us is their fault. Now, Trump doesn't point at the Jews when he says it's their fault. He points at immigrants, and he points at Chinese.
Did you see that commercial China. That the guy was referring to?
I did not.
So there's a 2016 commercial, and I did watch it, and it does talk about global forces, and it does have flash pictures of Soros and Yellen and
you'd think that Donald Trump, if he hates Yellen because she's a central banker, which is a legitimate reason to hate her, then why hasn't he advocated for getting rid of the Federal Reserve? Why isn't he advocating for replacing the Federal Reserve instead of just replacing Yellen? But no, I mean, Donald Trump has catered from the beginning, right, to conspiracy theories. I mean, wasn't he a birther? Wasn't that a big part of what he did for 2 years, 3 years? or the whole Bertha conspiracy. I mean, give me a break. This guy, and he wouldn't repudiate the Bertha conspiracy until late into the campaign when he was kind of forced to do so. So he is a conspiracy theorist, right? And, you know, so yes, so he doesn't agree with the conspiracy theory about the Elders of Zion or the Rothschilds controlling everything. But it doesn't matter. It's not the issue of which conspiracy. It's the principle.
It's no, and that's the whole thing, right? It's the mentality.
Yes.
And so the thesis that I was quoting was just, you know, to the extent that he is fostering the conspiracy mentality,
yes,
he is feeding into the same type of thinking that is behind anti-Semitism as it has existed for two millennia. And so
absolutely. And almost every conspiracy theory is about Jews, or most of them are. And you can see that, you know, I don't know, Stefan Molyneux now is all about Jewish conspiracies. I mean, it's everywhere. It's among libertarians. It's among alt-right. It really is everywhere. And Trump is capitalizing on it. You know, he'll capitalize on anything.
So then the question is, right, you know, because obviously the article is saying that this is part of the reason that you have a scumbag who goes into a synagogue in Pittsburgh and, you know, massacres people.
I think, you know, we're creating an atmosphere in which people feel like violence is the only alternative. Violence is the only thing left to them because reason is out. No politician in our world today, no prominent politician in our world today advocates for reason, argues rationally for a cause. Everything is about emotion, hysteria, panic on both sides. And the consequence of that is that if you can't deal with one another based on reason, all you have left is emotion. Emotion can convince one way or the other, so all you really have left is force. So when we get into an argument, since we can't refer to facts, since we can't refer to reality, all we've got is I feel this way, you feel that way. Again, this is my problem with microaggressions and safe spaces and the snowflakes of the left. It's the same thing on the left. But then if the right answer to this nonsense on the left is, oh, you know, stop it. It's just hysteria, you know, hysteria from the right, emotionalism from the right. Then what do you have left? You have the right and the left, each anchored to their own irrationality, and the only way they can interact is through violence and through force. And I think what you're going to see is more and more of this. You're going to see more and more people on the left attacking the right and physically, violently, and more people on the right attacking people on the left violently. I mean, think about the left. Think about what they've called this. You know, it's not the opposition. What is it? What is the big opposition to Trump, the movement that's against Trump? It's
something about leaving, but what is it?
No, it's not leaving. It's
oh, not that one?
Come on,
okay.
People. What is it? it's something like the opposition, but more dramatic, right?
Oh, okay. I'm
the resistance. The resistance.
That's right, the resistance.
Now, the resistance is not typically, you don't think of resistance as passive. You think of the resistance as we're buying weapons, we're hunkering down, we're going out there to get them.
It's not Muse's form of resistance. You know,
no.
Muse has this great song called The Resistance.
No.
Love is our resistance.
Yes.
So, you know,
it's not Muse's form of resistance.
It's not
love.
That kind, right?
It's
yeah.
not resistance is not rational. It's not we're going to argue. It's not we're going to debate. It's not we're going to prove you wrong. It's we're going to resist, which means force. So our whole political world out there is focused on force. And then what happens, just to go back to Pittsburgh, what happens is you've got these crazy individuals who are nuts to begin with and who have conspiracy theories and think the world is insane and everything. And then the media and Donald Trump and everybody else tells them there's an invasion. People are coming in from Honduras and El Salvador and they're invading the country and the government isn't doing anything about it. And they're being funded by Jews, by this Jewish
Hebrew
refugee.
Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. I've got a link,
the
by
Hebrew
the way.
Hebrew Immigrant Society. And then by George Soros, the Jew. And it doesn't matter whether any of that is true, whether anybody says the Jew, but it's George Soros, and this guy knows he's a Jew because he's read all the conspiracy theories about George Soros, and he puts it all together, and he said, it's like, the world is coming to an end. What am I going to do? I need to do something. I need to defend my people. And he goes on, and he kills a bunch of Jews. Now, I'm not saying he's sane. I'm not saying anybody provoked him. I'm just saying, when you get to the kind of culture that we are living through, where people are panicking and where the media scares us to death and nobody is looking at objective facts and everything is through the glasses of partisanship, then the wackos are going to get guns. And the wackos on the left and on the right are going to start shooting stuff up. You saw it with the guy who shot the congressman, right? I mean, the guy who shot the congressman, the same thing. I mean, there was this hysteria about these leftist politicians and how evil they are, and they're going to destroy America. Well, somebody said, so I better do something about it. I'm going to be a patriot. I'm going to go out and kill some of these politicians who do this. And they're insane. So it's not that anybody sent them on. These are crazy people, but they're crazy people within a context. And in this context, their craziness is manifesting in violent action against the, quote, other side.
Right, exactly.
Somebody accused me again of having Trump derangement syndrome. Trump derangement syndrome is exactly the point that I'm making, that we can't have discussions. You can't hear criticisms. You can't analyze criticisms reasonably. When you hear somebody like me talking factually about the many, 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 many weaknesses of or vices of Donald Trump, the immediate response is Trump derangement syndrome, and you don't have to say anything else, right?
It's a disease. As a matter of fact, I've got
you can shut people up like that, but that is exactly the symptom of the deep, deep disease, which is the lack of actual engagement of thought. If I'm wrong, then just tell me I'm wrong. Just take point my point and show me how I'm wrong. But to label it, and I see this all the time, everywhere people are labeling, to label somebody that is emotionalistic, not just emotionalist, but it's cowardice.
Fallacious,
and
it's
fallacious. And it's of course, again, this labeling, this them against us, complete ignoring facts, reality, and reason. And this is how it all happens. And Gavin, you said up on top in the chat that you were going to unsubscribe. There are few people in the world that I say this to, but please unsubscribe. Your anti-Semitic bullshit is, I don't need it. Go away. All right. Sorry.
So one thing, a while ago when I was doing my own show, one time I talked about a story that I had come across that discussed a study. And the study showed that in universities today, they do not teach critical thinking properly.
Yeah.
And so I made the connection between the lack of people knowing how to think critically and them feeling like they are incapable of putting forth an argument or a criticism of an argument. And so when you feel like you don't have the ability to analyze arguments and criticize them and put forth your own views rationally, then you are going to get emotional and think that violence is the only answer. So I don't have that in the program notes, but I was thinking maybe I should have put that in there. What I do have in the program
but
notes.
But it's also, it's good to refer to my conversation with Brad Thompson about the state of education, where we talk in depth about the fact that it is indeed the way we educate kids that is leading to these kind of pathologies.
Yeah. And there's one article that is in the program notes for today that is relevant. And it is New York Times. So kudos to New York Times for putting this out there. It asks, why are we still teaching reading the wrong way? And they talk about the fact that, yes, any scientific study that you have about how to best teach reading points to phonics, the use of phonics instruction for reading, and that nonetheless, you have these militant people who are high up in the education of education, so to speak, the people who teach the teachers, who are, quote, philosophically opposed to, making reading education based on science, which means using phonics, which means actually teaching people to read.
And they dominate. That's what's, and of course, they all go through the same teacher colleges. They're all taught that you're not supposed to teach phonics. Why? because it's memorization. I don't know what, why. I don't, phonics is the one I just don't get how they can reject it, because the science is unequivocal. Science is unequivocal in terms of the superiority of phonics. And yet so many schools don't teach phonics, and the results are crippling the kids' minds.
So
does the article try to explain why so many teachers teach Site C in spite of its pathetic scientific basis?
It's asking the question and complaining and talking about the prevalence of rejecting it. And I don't know about it.
Well, good for the New York Times. Here's one cheer for the New York Times for actually doing a story about the benefits of phonics and the evil or the badness of not teaching reading through phonics. But yeah, and that's one of a thousand sins that our educational institutions are committing on a daily basis, right?
Yeah. So the only last thing on Pittsburgh that I had was, if you actually read the things that the scumbag had posted on social media, he had some Gab account. They were very similar to the sort of things that you were referring to earlier. Invaders and the caravan and, you know, they're going to destroy the country and all. He was echoing exactly that. And he saw apparently the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society as somebody who, you know, or an organization that was the enemy because of them providing support for refugees and migrants and stuff. Yeah. And I guess decided he'd go into the synagogue and get a bunch of them. And that was what he said.
I return to how we started. I mean, I think Donald Trump, to a large extent, is responsible for creating an environment. And it's not just Trump. It's everybody around him, and it's the left as well. But our politicians, our leaders today, are responsible, and Trump is at the forefront of this, are responsible for creating an environment in which conspiracy theories are thriving, and in which people, more and more and more people, I think that it is okay to use violence to achieve your end. And partially the reason is that everything is perceived as an emergency, right? So unless I do this, the world's going to end. You know, unless we stop the caravan, America as we know it will end. Every 2 weeks, there's something equivalent to a caravan that's going to destroy America. Now, we can have debates about the caravan, what to do with it, whether to turn them back, how to turn them back, what are the actual laws in the United States say. That's kind of important. You know, what would be legal to do and what would be illegal to do based on the laws of the United States. How many people actually end up arriving in the U.S. if they're part of a caravan? In the past, very few, it turns out. How many people seek asylum? Are they refugees? Are any of them Muslims? Maybe terrorists? I mean, you can talk about all this, and you can talk about remedies and solutions and what to do about it and how to address it. And we can even disagree about these things. But 7,000 people are marching towards the border to panic, to present it as a massive crisis, to send the troops to the border. All of that feeds the hysteria, the emotionalism, the panic, the emotionalism. And I mean, that's how we get the world that we get. And again, Trump is providing lots of examples of this, but the same is happening, or to a less extent, but some of this stuff is also happening on the left. Somebody says Trump approves of Benjamin Netanyahu. What's that got to do with anything we've discussed here? And the fact is, I don't approve of Benjamin Netanyahu. I think Benjamin Netanyahu is a wuss. And I've said this many, many times. Benjamin Netanyahu has sold Israel down, you know, whatever. I don't know what the analogy I'm trying to get is. He sold them out.
Down the river.
Trying to recognize Jerusalem based on his embassy there. Good. That's great. Good for Trump. Trump has the Jewish grandkids. Good. Good for Trump. Has anybody said Trump is an anti-Semite? No. Nobody has said Trump is an anti-Semite.
Not saying that
not
at all.
Not a single person has said that over
again,
here. So
this is the whole thing.
This is my point, S.
My
Bain.
Primary criticism of Trump has always been methodological.
Yes.
It's how much does he inspire an authoritarian atmosphere so that people just take him as some authority unquestioningly? How much is he fueling conspiracy theories? How much does he blatantly disregard the principles on which our country was founded? He doesn't even mention them in his inaugural address. It started there.
No. Well, but he didn't mention it in the campaign. He's never mentioned it, really.
No. But I'm saying, you know, he's a classic classic pragmatist. And that is my primary problem with him, you know, that to the extent that he does good things, and he does sometimes do good things, you can never be confident that those good things are going to be forthcoming in the future, because they're not based on anything solid within him at all.
But he's worse than a pragmatist, right?
Yeah, we've talked about this before, right? Because, you know, I always point to the pragmatism, and you point to the denial of reality, right?
I point to the emotionalism and denial of reality. I point to the panic, the hysteria that it creates. And relevant to this, what happened in Pittsburgh is, and what happened with the guy who sent the bombs in the mail, you know, I'm really glad they didn't explode, but still, the idea that you would do that. But all the wackos coming out of the woodwork, relevant to all of that is his you know, real emotionalism and his bombastic tendency to make everything bombastic and to make everything an emergency, and the world is going to end unless he takes some action, unless one of these wackos takes some action. If Donald
Trump
can't.
Okay, so then the question is, Yaron, are you blaming Trump for this guy going into the synagogue?
No, I'm not blaming him. Of course not. I mean, the responsibility for going into the synagogue, shooting people, is on the crazy person who did it. I'm saying is, there is a causal relationship between more situations where these kind of things can happen, and I think we might see that, and an atmosphere that's created which suggests that the only way to solve problems is through violence, and because reason is out the window. So I've always – you've gone after the pragmatism, which I agree completely, and the sec I usually go after the emotionalism. It's the fact that it is so driven by emotionalism. Right.
So I don't know if you want to shift, but I was going to shift a little bit to what Trump is doing in the days leading up to the election, this midterm election, and, you know, trying to appeal to everybody by putting last minute policy proposals out there, sometimes where he's just surprising his administration and staff and everybody, you know. So he is at a rally and suddenly he says there's going to be a 10% middle class tax cut. And this is the first that anybody's heard of it, basically. And so they're all scrambling to see if they can get Congress to pass a resolution that they might give you a 10% tax cut later. The latest was what I read this morning, and then I posted about it and got all kinds of blowback. It was that the president wants to use executive order to end birthright citizenship.
Yes,
again,
yes,
because
yes.
Birthright citizenship is, you know, brings in the enemy, these other invading hordes and stuff that are going to destroy our country. So if, you know, if he can tell people as a campaign promise or whatever that he's going to end that.
But he can't. The courts would, I don't think the courts would allow him, because I think it's clear. What is it? The 14th Amendment, I think it is, or the 17th Amendment. The 14th Amendment at least the courts have never ruled otherwise. The courts have always ruled that if you're born in the U.S., you're a U.S. citizen. And they've never discriminated between those born in the U.S. From legal residents, although he said that he would make it so that even legal residents, their child would not be born. You basically have to be in a green card or about to become a citizen or something. I don't know. But anyway, it's going to be really interesting, because I think it'll be fought in the courts, and I think he'll probably lose. But that's not the point, and this goes back to your point about pragmatism. Right. The point of Donald Trump is not getting stuff done. It's not about what will happen. It's about getting votes. So if he can say things, and again, he is the producer of more fake news than all the media put together. So if he can say stuff like, I'm going to lower middle class taxes. And if there's a chunk of the population out there that doesn't read, that doesn't investigate, that doesn't actually check, then, okay, they believe him, and maybe they get excited about going to vote for him because they want tax cuts, and they're unhappy with the previous tax cuts because they only cut taxes on the rich. So he is a professional BSer. He will say anything that he believes. I mean, it's what he told 60 Minutes. He said it was in the context of Ford and in the context of his kind of dismissal of her testimony, the way he did it. And he said, it doesn't matter. We won. So for Donald Trump, nothing matters except winning. So if you have to stomp on other people, if you have to lie, if you have to make stuff up, if you have to pretend, I mean, what he's doing is pretending, because the tax cuts can only come from Congress. They can't come from the president. There's no legislation, even in committee. There's no legislation being debated about tax cuts.
Nobody in his administration, advisors, nobody knew he was thinking of this. He just, 1984 style, you know, where the guy from Oceania, you know, announces something in the middle of the rally or whatever. Just right in the middle of the rally is the first it exists.
And of course, it would take 6 months to happen. And he's implying it's going to happen before the midterm election. So again, complete detachment from reality. And then he says, what was the other thing? This thing about no mention of the Constitution, no mention of the courts, no mention that it's unclear that he as president has even the authority to do what he says he's going to do, because the authority should be with Congress to determine naturalization. But it's in the Constitution, so somebody's going to have to interpret the Constitution, assume the Supreme Court.
And then here's the standard, right? So when Obama said, oh, well, I've got my pen and my phone, right? Everybody complained on the right.
Yeah.
And now when Trump says, hey, I got my pen and my phone, but I'm going to end birthright citizenship, which you hate.
A constitutional issue. He's going to end.
Then people say, oh, well, this is great because it's going to get the ball rolling. It's going to start, you know, oh, it's going to be challenged in courts anyway and everything else. People have a different standard in evaluating what Trump does than they did with Obama.
Yep.
With Obama, everybody was very critical of his expansion of executive power. And with Trump, people are celebrating it. You know, he's getting things done. He's starting a conversation. It's going to be challenged in the courts anyway. Who cares? No, there's a principle here, which is that you should go through a proper procedure if you want to amend the Constitution.
Or if you want to challenge the Constitution, then do it through Congress. But, you know, again, whether you don't like anchor babies or whatever, I, by the way, love anchor babies. Here are babies that are born under freedom. Cool. I think that's wonderful for the babies. I think it's wonderful for the world. More babies born under freedom, the better world will be.
I had somebody suggest that everybody who's born here, not just quote legal residents, you know, children of legal residents or children of illegal, but everybody who's born shouldn't automatically be made a citizen.
Well, I'm actually more sympathetic to that, right? I have some sympathy to that. I've said before, I think citizenship should be hard, and I'm not sure Americans born should be automatically citizens, because I think you should have a certain knowledge and a certain understanding of the principles on which the country is founded. Now, because I'm you should be able to live here and your rights be protected up to a point, even if you're not a citizen. But to be a citizen, in other words, to vote, I think you have to take a test. So, and I think maybe, and this is just me hypothesizing here, I think maybe everybody should have to take the test, including people who were born in America.
Okay, but then you would say that even those children who were born here from parents who were here illegally, as we'll call it for purposes of discussion, those kids should be allowed to be legal residents.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But you know, I believe that.
So that's what they care about. Yeah, they care about jobs,
know.
You know, competition for jobs.
Well, no, but they claim, at least the people on the right claim, that they care about voting. And my system would solve the problem of voting. Somebody says here, you're on one Starship Troopers. To some extent I do. I mean, this is a Robert Heinlein novel in which in order to become a citizen, you have to serve in the military. So everybody's equal before the law. Everybody's rights are protected. You're a legal resident. But to be a voting citizen, and to be able to be elected to political house, to be elected in Starship Trooper, you have to be
someone who served in the military.
You have to serve in the military. So I think there should be standards. I actually think there should be two standards for citizenship. And again, this is not objectivism. This is not Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand never said this. This is me, what I believe when we get there. These are the kind of ideas that people will be debating. I believe you will have to, one, you would have to pass a test. Two, you would actually have to pay taxes. So I think taxes should be voluntary. If you don't pay them, fine. But one of the things that happens is you don't get to vote. you can't be elected to government, right? So the only way to vote or to be elected is if you're a taxpayer. This gets rid a little bit of the free rider problem. So yeah, so I actually like, Starship Trooper has a little bit of a fascist tendency to it, but Robert Heinlein was a smart guy. I mean, at the end he was an anarchist, but he was a smart, I liked some of his books.
I don't like the idea of everybody being required to do military service.
No, neither do I. No. That I would take out. But taxes and a test.
Although I guess there are different sorts of roles you could play within military service. So you could work intelligence or other things that don't necessarily require you to be good at physical combat, for example. But
Somebody's asking about minimal taxes for police, military, and courts. No, I mean, the fact is the taxes would be voluntary. So, those minimal taxes would be, but they would be voluntary. But one of the things that would happen if you didn't pay them, would you couldn't vote. Now, there'd be other consequences. I think social I can never say the word.
Ostracization,
something like that. Even Amy can't say the word, so it's not just me.
Ostracization.
Yeah. Anyway, going back to this, the panic of sending troops to the border, the panic. I mean, all of this, again, creates a certain atmosphere, but it also is in my view, if everybody's blaming, I don't know, Soros and the left for creating the caravan. I think Trump paid for the caravan. Now, I'm kidding. So don't get all you're on is a conspiracy theorist. But this caravan is the best thing to happen to Republicans ever. Now, I think it's gone off the news because of Pittsburgh and other things, the caravan coming in was great for Republicans. I mean, somebody says I'm the only one panicking. Really? 5,000 troops to the border is not panicking when you're talking about 7,000 migrants?
Actually, I heard that only about 2,000 are going to end up really.
I think it's going to be less than 1,000 actually reach the American border. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that the Border Patrol arrests more people than that every day. Every day. They arrest 400. They stop 400,000 people trying to enter the United States every year. That is on average over 1,000 people a day. Why? Why are we sending troops to the border? About 7,000 people. That I would think was panic, and that's Trump. Now I don't think Trump is panic. I don't think the generals are panicked. I think Trump is trying to say to his voters, "Look, I'm the only person standing between you and an invasion. I'm the only person I'm the only person protecting this country. Come out and vote for Republicans, because the Democrats would just, you know, we would be overrun with these people if not for Republicans." So he has played the caravan perfectly for his base. He has used it. He has manipulated it. He has, again, emotionalized it. That's not a word, but turned it into this emotional issue that will bring people to the polls. And to the extent that I think Republicans are motivated to show up and vote, I think the caravan will have a huge part in that.
Right.
Okay.
So here's your option, Yaron, because I mean, we've talked about he's stirring up this emotionalist conspiracy ridden mentality he's worsening the environment that he inherited. He inherited some of this, but he's making it worse, right? And so now we're looking at potentially, I don't know if this is really going to happen. I've got the headline, Hillary is possibly going to run in 2020. So if you had a ballot in front of you and you could choose to vote for Hillary, Trump.
I still would vote, I mean, for either one of them. And
okay.
Because I think it would be a disaster if she got elected. But I don't think we'll ever face that. I don't think the Democrats are going to nominate Hillary Clinton. They'll nominate potentially somebody worse. I mean, imagine Elizabeth Warren versus Donald Trump. What do you do then? I mean, Donald Trump has created that atmosphere. But this atmosphere is also created by the limitations on free speech on campuses, Antifa, all that the left is doing and the rise of socialism, Bernie Sanders is nonsense. So I think what you're getting is it's happening on both sides. Donald Trump keeps feeding it and exaggerating it. And I talked about the walk away movement before, I think on Sunday. there are all these people stuck in the middle who, you know, are trying to hold on to some rationality, and it's almost impossible to hold on to any rationality in a world so dominated by emotion and hysteria and panic and incivility and ugliness and you know, anyway, I mean, I don't want to say more about Donald Trump because then
But so you don't want to vote for Hillary either. By the way, I did see a social media thread today in which you and I were nominated as not that you're eligible.
I'm not eligible. I'd vote for you if but you would lose in a landslide. Sorry, Amy.
Of course I would lose. It could be educational, but I would lose. Of course. Huge.
Yeah. I mean, the only reason he sent troops down to the border, people at. Is in order to show his muscle, in order to pander to his voters, in order to pretend that immigration is this national emergency, that you have to vote Republican in order to stop the national emergency. I do not think. There is no national emergency with regard to immigration into the United States. Illegal and illegal immigration into the United States is down. Anyway, I don't want to get into the whole discussion of immigration, but you know, again, the Border Patrol is doing fine. What do you need 5,000? What do you need 5,000 troops though, if not for a photo op for an election? And I think what's going to happen. We haven't talked about this. We didn't make it a topic in our thing, but Corinne has a question, so we'll get to Corinne's question after this. We haven't talked about the midterm elections, but. It's quite possible the Republicans are going to do a lot better than expected. Mm-hmm. And I think a large extent, although I think maybe because of what happened last week, the energy behind the Republicans has maybe dissipated a little bit. But I think the reason is the fact that the leftists – there's one other issue that Donald Trump brought up to play to his electorate, and that was the transgender issue that he brought up again, saying, look, I'll stand up for you. Whatever, and if the left gets in control, these transgenders will be everywhere. And so he brought it up now because it was before the election. I think the left is so pathetic. The left is so bad that, and they've been so bad leading up during these midterms with the issues that they focused on and the emphasis that they put on things that, you know, the right is motivated by how ugly the left is. And I hope that I think at the end of the day, I mean, this is the thing, this goes back to Leonard Peikoff's dim hypothesis. I think at the end of the day, Americans will always reject nihilism, And they won't discriminate in terms of what they reject nihilism for. And I think the left, and I've said this many times, and I know everybody disagrees with me. I think the left is the weaker enemy because I don't think the left can win, not systematically, not they might win that, they'll win the House this time, but they can't win. They can't dominate because Americans won't have it. Even I think younger Americans ultimately don't want the nihilism.
Anti-value. Yeah, they want to be promised something positive.
They want something positive. And I think that's why I think the left wins on issues long-term. So they get their stuff passed, but they don't dominate politically. They don't win in the ballot box. And I think the trend is going to continue. If you look at since Reagan, the Republicans have dominated the ballot box, the governorships, House of Representatives, Senate, White House. Maybe the presidency has been weaker, but everything else the Republicans have dominated. And I think it's because of the nihilism of the left. And I think it's because the left has gone so far out and become wacky. And I think as Americans reject that, what they'll find is that they're supporting a wacky right. And I think that is going to be much harder to, and Greg Sullivan says the complicating factor is the nihilism's on the right as well. Yes, but I think it's a different kind of nihilism, and it's a nihilism disguised as nationalism and patriotism, and it's disguised with values. And it's much more appealing.
Everybody believes that Donald Trump loves this country, is what I hear. So
it's
much,
appealing
right?
to Americans. And that's why they'll be fooled into jumping on the right's bandwagon. And at the end of the day, not in the short run, but the end, I think Leonard's right. Nihilism generally is a failed strategy for political power. That at the end of the day, somebody will have to clean up the mess that Trump and the left and everybody else has made, and the only thing that can clean up the mess is maybe a more rigorous nationalism, but more likely it's some form of religion, because even though people are supposed to be becoming less religious, it's the idea of an integrating factor, a force that has a clear message and a promising future, and at the end of the day, that'll clean up the dangers that cleans up the nihilism of both left and right. But in the meantime, I think the right is more appealing to people because it hides its nihilism better, put it that way. The left now is nakedly nihilistic. The right still pretends to stand for something.
Yeah, so the nihilism is all the way through, and then in the right, it hasn't been thoroughly integrated out. They're trying to be compartmentalized.
Well, in the right, it's still a smaller faction.
And hold values and hold up values, you
yes.
know. America first.
Yes.
Well, what does America stand for? Well,
nothing in the end. That's the nihilism. Yeah. But they can disguise it. They can pretend that it stands for something.
Okay. So in terms of midterms, for me, all I've been sort of looking at is I have to have a reason to actually go to the ballot because I don't feel like I really want to vote for either of the parties that I have a choice of right now. I don't see that a whole lot matters in this short term. But I've looked at ballot initiatives, and just to make you feel happy that you left California, Yaron, I'll let you know that in California they are proposing to bring back rent control. Apparently in 95 there was some legislation that was passed that said anything that's built after 1995 could not be subjected to rent control or something like that, and now they're trying to have an initiative on the ballot that would undo that would open, you know, the possibility at least for cities locally to institute rent control on these more recently built properties. And of course, it's important to go to the ballot and just vote no all over that stuff. The one good thing, there's, you know, all these ballot initiatives are usually just, you know, should the government steal your money and spend it on this, or should it control this price over here?
Yeah.
And you just go, no, you know, all the way down. But
that's the main reason I used to go vote when I lived in California, was to vote on the ballot initiatives, because they actually had a direct impact on your life. I usually lost the important ones. We did win a few, like gay marriage and marijuana. So the ones where I align with the so-called left, so-called left, because those are not leftist issues really, were the ones I won. But the ones that had to do with taxes and stealing and all of that, we always lose on those in California. And this one
will
lose.
I'm going to vote.
We will
and
lose.
Actually, something that's promising, though, is from what I understand, this initiative is set up right now, at least according to the polls, to fail.
Oh, good.
60-40.
Wow.
I hope that holds. I'm going to, of course, vote against it. So anybody who's in California within the sound of my voice, take a look at it for yourself. Make up your own mind. But if you're like me, you do not think that rent control has been proven to be a disaster every time it's been tried in economics. How do they somehow allowing cities to pursue rent control as an option is going to help a housing shortage in any way? Can you see any conceivable way that somebody who's rational and benevolent could think this, Yaron?
No. No, but it's the same thing with minimum wage. There's no difference, right? It's the same thing with a million other stimulus packages and a million other economic policies that are very popular and, you know, and often very popular both left and right. And yet, it doesn't matter. Reality doesn't matter to these people. You know, it's the same with socialism, right? Who in their right mind would think socialism still works?
Yeah.
Well, they're not in their right mind. And I'm surprised that it's losing in California 60-40. That's a good sign. I think because people are tempted by the idea, it goes like this. Rents are out of control in California. They're so high, nobody can afford to live there. So if we give the government some power to rein in the rents, to lower the rents, then people will be able to afford and the world will be wonderful. And of course, you know, all the consequences of that, they forget, even though, as you said, it's been tried and we know exactly what those consequences are. Perhaps
the opposition has conducted an effective communication campaign, you know,
seen anything?
Well, I don't watch TV really that much. I mean, I'm sure it's on all the TV ads and things like that.
Yeah, the problem is with all the TV ads is, again, it's emotional pandering by each side to the other, and nobody tries to educate the public about what is really going on. And maybe it's because the public is not interested in being educated. Maybe it goes back to what we talked about earlier about the level of education in our country, or the quality of the education in our country.
Yeah, not thinking critically, not being taught to read properly, those sorts of things too. Yeah. I did remember one thing, by the way, about that reading article, and they had said that they were of the belief that all you had to do was expose kids to a lot of good books that they would enjoy, and that somehow reading would come naturally if you just expose them.
Yeah, that goes back to, I don't think Dewey had it necessarily that theory, but it comes out of that progressive education school. Yes, I mean, children will learn naturally if they're motivated to learn. So, yeah, you know, they'll just pick up a book and they'll learn to read because they're motivated.
Don't need
they
a methodology of any kind. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. So do you want to talk about Germany or Italy next? Because both have some interesting things going on in the news.
Well, either one. I mean, I think either one is fine. I mean, Germany, Angela Merkel, her party has lost significant amount of votes in some of the regional elections in Germany. I think it was last week or earlier this week.
Oh, okay.
And her party basically, I looked at it. Somebody posted a chart where it showed that all the votes that her party lost went to the far right political party, the more xenophobic political party, certainly the anti-Islamic immigration political party, but also the political party that has at least roots or certain features of the neo-Nazis. They've tried to clean it up. They've washed themselves off of it. They claim they're not, and they brought in new people and so on. But they're clearly the more nationalist, and particularly anti-Islamic immigration. I mean, obviously, Merkel made a massive mistake with the mass migration of Muslims into Germany, a mistake motivated completely by altruism, by letting them all in and encouraging them and sending a message to the Syrian refugees that they were welcome in Germany and they should all come. And a million showed up. And, I've spoken about mass migration. I don't believe in mass migration. That's why I find this 7,000 people said caravan a little funny, because that's, as compared to real mass migration. It's different. You have to have a process. You have to be able to screen people. You have to be able to do something. You can't just allow a million people to cross into your border randomly. You also don't hand them checks and keep them out of the labor market, which is what Germany is doing. So you've got a bunch of young Middle Eastern men who can't get a job. And you're paying them not to have a job. And it's just the whole Germany's policy is just a disaster. So she lost the votes to the AfD and also to the Greens, but primarily the AfD. And the message is clear. While she won the last elections, barely, Germany is tired of her, is tired of her politics, is tired of the centrist, tired of moderation, and is moving, on the one hand, to further to the right in terms of the nationalist right, and further to the left in terms of the Green Party, which in Germany is not quite as wacky as you'd think in terms of environmentalists, but still, bad. And so she's announced that she won't run for re-election in 2021, I think, when the next parliamentary election is in Germany. And, I'm no fan of Angela Merkel. I mean, she's not of the possibilities of what Germany could have. She's not that bad. She's kind of a centrist who's not particularly pro markets, but not particularly against markets. But she's not a nationalist, which is always good for Germany. I talked about the European Union in my thing about nationalism. I am moderately a fan of the European Union. I think it has indeed reduced the amount of violence in Europe. I think it's reduced I think it's gone off the deep end now, and but it needs to, it should be reined in, and Germany's the only country that could do it.
The whole early rationale for the EU, because I did a little bit of studying on the EU government for my GDPR certification that I got in the summer, and time and again, you would see that the rationale was to make it easier to open up trade in between the countries. That was the primary thing, and in fact, you know, they were willing, with respect to privacy, of course, to put a premium of free trade above privacy as well, right? So, no, that was the original rationale, but I agreed with you. I watched that show or heard that show. And, you know, the regulation that they ended up putting as well is the big problem.
Yeah, but to establish a union of states, of a bunch of little ethnic states that it doesn't make any sense to have them to begin with. Right. And the reason Europe is in such a mess, I think, has to do to a large extent with this ethnic-based nationalism that exists in Europe. To create a union of these states, which simply allows for free movement of capital, labor, and people, capital, labor, and goods, is fabulous. I mean, there's no downside to that. The downside happens when leftists start taking over these and then go beyond the mandate and start regulating and controlling and limiting and restricting and imposing their status and turning a bunch of little states into one big state that violates rights. So, you know, what would be great if, I mean, I would love to see Europe become the United States of Europe with a government that protected rights. But that's not the government they're going to get.
In the United States, you know, we have the Interstate Commerce Clause.
Yeah. Yeah.
And originally that clause was primarily understood to allow the federal government to eliminate barriers to trade between the states. And then increasingly, as our country got less and less free over a couple hundred some odd years, we have seen that clause be interpreted so as to allow the federal government to itself regulate that trade. And that's really unfortunate, because as I understand it, the original understanding of it more was just to permit trade and
it's original
intent. Government to eliminate trade barriers between states.
But the fact is, there's a lot of opposition. The AfD in Germany would like Germany to have more independence from the EU, and that relates to Italy, where the government in Italy is clearly an anti-EU government, and it relates to the rise of a lot of political parties all over Europe that are nationalist in the bad sense of the word, and that, you know, are very interested in leaving the EU, or at least in threatening to leave the EU, you know, and none of that is, I don't think that's good for Europe. I mean, it's one thing for the UK to leave the EU in the guise of we're going to establish freer markets, but Italy would not establish freer markets, and it's unlikely Germany would. And
now there's no movement within Germany to leave the EU. It's only in Italy that we're starting to see this right now.
No. AfD would love to leave the EU at the end of the day, I think. In France, obviously, the National Front would love to leave the EU. So Marie Le Pen would love to leave.
So in every country.
Oh, every country.
Some, but it's only Italy that they're in power right now.
Geert Wilders in the Netherlands would love to leave the EU. The political party that just did very well in the Swedish election, not as well as people anticipated, but still very well in the Swedish election. I think the Social Democrats, I can't remember their name, I think that's what their name is, would love to leave the EU. All of this there is a huge rise. And of course, you've got politicians, you've got these nationalists in Eastern Europe, from Poland to Hungary, who haven't left the EU because they can't afford to. I mean, one of the things about Orban in Hungary that nobody talks about is that his economy would collapse if he left the EU, but he talks as if he wants to leave the EU.
Well, and so
no, I mean, the EU is no way like the Soviet Union. I mean, come on, guys. As much as the EU regulates, as bad as the EU is, and now there was just these freedom of speech or lack of freedom of speech decisions at the EU that are just horrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to understand what the Soviet Union was. Nothing in Europe today is like the Soviet Union. Not even Russia today is like the Soviet Union. Russia is much closer to being like the Soviet Union than Europe is, than the EU. The EU, I mean, you go to Europe, you know, I mean, anybody who's beat the Soviet Union and lands in Paris or goes to Berlin would not confuse the two.
No, look at this. So, for example, I've got in the program notes, again, my program notes are at the blog, don'tletitgo.com. I've got a link to a Freedom of Thought report for 2018, a ranking index. And in terms of freedom of thought, to the extent that that is protected in countries, first two countries are there in the EU. You've got Belgium.
I'm skeptical.
Are you?
Yes, because the EU has hate laws which apply to those countries.
Okay. So
hate
then the
speech
question is
laws,
now,
sorry, hate speech
now
laws.
That was just passed but after this.
No, no, the hate speech laws have been on the books forever. So I bet you that in Belgium it is illegal to be a Holocaust denier. You would go to jail. At least you would in Germany. And you wouldn't, you know, France has very strong hate speech laws, has had it for years.
Germany is way down the list as far as I can tell.
So I would be curious what the difference is between somebody like Belgium, which is number one on that list, and Germany, given that a lot of the laws coming down are coming down from the EU and not just from the local governments. But, you know, on the Economic Freedom Survey, most EU countries are in the top 10th.
Yeah, so Germany is way down, 145.
Seriously?
Or 127, I guess. Yeah, way down the list. Below Philippines, below Zambia, below Haiti, Rwanda, Jamaica.
So we need to read the study.
All of those.
We need to read the study and figure out exactly what it means. Because that doesn't make sense either. I mean, Germany should be low, but not that low. What are they measuring? I'm skeptical.
Okay, so freedom of thought. And it says here what it means is. Oh, God, it has all kinds of technical terminology here. Four thematic strands are constitution and government, education and children's rights, society, community, and family, and freedom of expression, advocacy, and humanist values.
Yeah, it's some left wing. I'm just skeptical. I mean, I'd read the criteria, how they measure, and all of this stuff. And
U.S. ties for six. Or actually ties for number eight, I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense. But Germany, 145, it sounds like Germany's an authoritarian state where you can't say anything. That doesn't make any sense.
Okay.
Doesn't make any sense to me.
Fair enough. I mean, maybe it's just in a lot of these other countries, they haven't gotten around to make
that. I'm now, you've intrigued me. I'll have to read the actual report and find out. All right.
I'm just saying, if you've got a couple countries that rank much higher than United States, and they're
Corinne has a question. She just reminded me not to forget it. Okay, here's the question because she paid for it, so we should answer it before we end, and we're getting close. Should FBI monitor social media because shooters like Squirrel Hill once announced ahead of time their intention to shoot? I mean, yes, if it's public information. That is, if you put
anything
on a public board, not password protected, not behind anything stuff, then I think that the FBI should be just scanning it for certain words, for keywords, scanning it for certain specific people, for threats. And if you threaten, then I think they can get into your private stuff. Then they can get warrants and say there's probable cause, this person actually made a threat, and really monitor what you do. My objection is to the NSA, listening to private conversation I haven't put up online. If I put it up online, anybody can monitor
free
it,
game.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Free, it's, but
I mean, that's my biggest complaint is that they don't more effectively monitor what is posted publicly from this scumbag on Gab or whatever.
Yeah.
Why did they not? I mean, that was a couple hours before.
Well, and he's been saying it for months.
No, but he actually said a couple hours before he posted, I'm going in, I can't. Let these people destroy my country or something like that, right?
My guess is that happens a lot, and then people don't act on it, and they feel foolish, so they don't.
But still, it's like, Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, he appeared before Congress, and he was talking about the challenges of using AI to create, a less hate-filled environment or some, hate speech they're trying to go after. But he said that they had been very successful using AI to root out, for example, terrorists like ISIS and everything else. It seems like AI could tailor to be a lot more effective to go after incitement if they weren't dividing up their resources and saying, oh gosh, is somebody getting their feelings hurt or anything else? If they just put all their resources towards actually flagging any public post that was either a threat or an incitement to violence, a direct incitement to violence, and, you know, be very clear about what that is.
Yeah.
Maybe we could stop a scumbag before he does something.
No, I agree with you. If they, you know, if they stop monitoring, if the NSA put all those geniuses to work instead of bugging Angela Merkel's cell phone, to bring in Angela Merkel again, or to monitor drug deals, or to listen in on Brazilian negotiating a oil deal. If they spent all those resources instead on trying to catch bad guys, to find people with probable cause, to monitoring, you know, Muslims maybe, or people who have expressed radical, you know, Islamist views or jihadi views or anti-Semitic views or whatever, or Antifa views. If they went after anybody who's advocating for violence in any way, then, you know, I think we'd live in a much safer world.
I would be careful, right? I would say, okay, incitement, right? And you'd have to get very clear, and we'd get Steve Simpson to help us, you know, come up with a delineation. When is something an incitement versus not? You know, is, for example, some of the people that we've seen online talking about the fact that the government would be justified to shoot down the caravan or whatever, is that an incitement or is it not? And, you
but,
know, so
but I would, I mean, I don't think it has to reach the level of incitement. I think the number of categories, right?
So I would say Facebook would be entitled to take it down, and that might be a good policy, right? To take down that stuff.
Yes,
when the government should be.
But my point is, the government, I think, has a variety of different things. So first is, they should monitor publicly available information for signs of people advocating for or inciting or proposing violence.
Okay.
Because those are red flags, right? Then they should focus their attention without getting a warrant, because they're not going after private information. They should just pay more attention to those people who are using violent words, who are advocating for violence, shooting and stuff. Once it crosses the incitement line, wherever that happens to be, I don't think that's an
warrant,
easy line
to
define, but whenever that happens to be, then you get a warrant, then you listen into phone conversations, then you do whatever it takes in order to monitor them and make sure that they're not really up to something really bad. But I do think you pay attention to people talking about violence. You you focus more on them.
Yes, I agree.
Great. So, if anybody wants to ask a last minute question, the way to do it is to use the super chat. You can't just ask questions in the chat. It's not fair for the people who actually do put up money where their mouth is. So if a dollar, you can ask a question. So you can do that. In the meantime, I am going to encourage you to share today's show, to subscribe to Amy's YouTube channel and to my YouTube channel.
I think I need something like only 15 to reach 1,000.
Seriously,
now,
so 15 should be easy.
Close.
We should be able to generate 15 subscriptions to Amy's
but
YouTube
not the
channel.
Anti-Semitic
just one. From today's show, right? Just from the anti-Semites on my YouTube channel, you would get the 15. I don't think there were 15 on the thing. Maybe one or two. What else? And you gotta support Amy and my Patreon account. The end of the month is right here. Put a dollar in, I'll answer your question about Bolsonaro. We could have included that, but I forgot. But there was an election in Brazil, an important election in Brazil, a big time election in Brazil.
Did the guy win, the racist guy?
Well, I don't know that he's racist, but let me say a word after I tell people that they should support us on Patreon, that it's the end of the month, that, you know, I probably need another 10 people to support me on Patreon to reach my goal for the month, which is like a day. So it's unlikely, but who knows? You guys could all go do it, and that would be great. And if I answer the Bolsonaro question, will Jorge and Duababa, sorry if I slaughtered your names. Would you go to Patreon and make a contribution? That would be fantastic. Given that you're not using Super Chat, you could do it through Patreon. All right, so there was a big election in Brazil. Since 1998, all the Brazil has been dominated by wacky leftists, presidents, and wacky leftist policies of that have led to unbelievable corruption, that have led to
this horrible damage of the museum in Rio?
Well, that's because they didn't invest in it, but it's led to unbelievable crime all over. I mean, Rio is unbelievably violent, but so are many other, you know, so no focus on public safety. The focus on a lot of redistribution of wealth, buying votes of poor people, huge corruption because of state-owned enterprises, nationalization, and massive regulation. And while in the early part of the 2000s, it seemed like, or even in the later part of the 2000s, it seemed like things were okay because Brazil is rich in natural resources, and you can milk those natural resources, as Venezuela did for many years, and still appear to be fine. You know, the Brazilian economy went to hell once the price of natural resources post-financial crisis crashed, and the Brazilian economy has been in trouble since. In the meantime, during that period, through the investigation, through the courageous investigation of one judge and a bunch of district attorneys and some really, really brave policemen, they investigated the political class in Brazil and found massive corruption. I think there was a point at which half of all the members of parliament were on the indictment for corruption. Okay. The president, President Lula, who was president for a very, very popular president who served two terms and who almost ran now. The only reason he couldn't run now was because he's in jail, because they actually prosecuted him. They took him to court and they prosecuted him and they found him guilty. It went all the way up to the Brazilian Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court affirmed the decision and put him in jail for a long time. Then the woman who came after him, who was his heir apparent, she was then impeached and is now, I think, under indictment for corruption, and it might go to trial. The current president, who was her vice president, is corrupt. I mean, they're all corrupt. Anyway, so you've got this, the left is completely imploded. It's a complete destruction, and people can look at Venezuela and they can see the difference. The problem, of course, is what is the alternative? And Brazil, like the United States, chose a populist as an alternative, a religious, I think he's evangelical. I don't think he's Catholic in a very Catholic country, but I think Bolsonaro is evangelical. He's quite religious. He's anti-social freedoms. He's anti-gay, anti a lot of the social freedoms that, you know, and he's very much a populist, potentially dangerous, but on the other hand, one who's committed to public safety and so on, and we'll see if he lives up to it. And he's not a leftist. So after 1998 to today, that's 20 years of being ruled by leftist regimes that have crippled the country and destroyed it. They've now elected a populist, right-wing populist, who could be very dangerous. Now, the one good thing about Bolsonaro, first, the best thing about him is he's not the crazy lefties. I mean, the left in Brazil is far, far worse in terms of the economic policies than the left than Obama or even Clinton. I mean, I take Clinton over Lula any day. So these are real kind of Marxists. The good thing is he has run with an economic advisor by the name of Paulo Guedes, G-U-E-D-E-S. And Paulo Guedes is actually a really good economist. And Paulo Guedes has committed the next administration to privatizing, to liberalizing, to opening up, to lowering taxes, lowering tariffs, opening up the country to trade, and really doing some positive radical things, really good stuff to the Brazilian economy. Now, whether Bolsonaro will actually follow through with any of that, who knows, right? I don't know. But the fact that Paulo Guedes is still his economic advisor, as far as I know, since the election, he hasn't fired him. He won the election by 55-45, which is a fairly large margin. He's got a mandate. So one other problem in analyzing this, and then I'll let you go and let everybody go, and that is that while he won the presidency, Bolsonaro's political party is very small. So he has to form a coalition. The parliament in Brazil has I think when I read the last story I read, has 30 different political parties.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So he has to form a coalition. Even members within his own party are against the economically liberal policies of Paulo Guedes, liberal in the classical liberal sense, in the pro-capitalist sense. So who knows what's going to happen? Who knows?
So right now what's going on is he's trying to form this coalition, and until we know what that coalition is, we won't be able to
until he decides what he's actually going to do.
The liberal stuff he's going to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Paulo Guedes is a good guy. I actually met his daughter. His daughter is very interested in Ayn Rand, and we talked, and I did a little presentation to her group in Rio de Janeiro when I was there a couple of months ago. Really, really good people. I love Brazil. I love Brazilians. So anyway, I think it's good news, but it's going to depend on what they actually do and what they actually practice.
New York Times did not like him. They said he's all, sexist and sort of racist.
Well, I mean, again, the panic on the left, they called him a far right candidate. I mean, he's right, but he's not a far right. He's not a fascist. He's potentially can be bad in all kinds of ways, but I don't think it's anything like that. Okay, so we got two Super Chat questions quickly. I watched the lecture you did a few years back. Firearms came up. You were a bit mixed about them. I wonder if you have changed your thoughts on them. No, I haven't changed my thoughts on them. And I think actually Amy agrees with me on this. I think it's a complex issue. Ayn Rand thought it was a complex issue, not simple and straightforward. And my basic views on firearms have not changed since then. Of course, very few people actually understand my basic views on firearms, even though I've tried to explain it many times.
I mean, in essence, it's that you have a right to have some means of self-defense through a gun, but that the government would be proper to regulate exactly what caliber and things like that.
Government is responsible for force. The government is responsible for the instruments of force. And the instruments that are only to be used in force, the government has some power over them in terms of regulating them. And that's part of the role of government.
Yeah,
it's part of the natural
role. Police can't be all places, all times, so it is appropriate for you to have something for self-defense,
okay,
but what it is.
Does objectivism preclude the idea of sensation as an innate attribute to matter? I don't even know what that means. Sorry. Does objectivism preclude the idea of sensation? Oh, I see. That all matter can sense. Yes, I think there's clearly two different things.
Yeah. I would say my first answer would be you'd have to give me some evidence for all matter sensing, right? Because we do have evidence that, animals sense, and that there may be even that there's some evidence that plants, there's maybe something going on, with them, but all matter.
Yeah, but
where's the evidence?
Yeah, that's what makes life. That's what differentiates life from non-living things.
So, where would the evidence be? That would be my biggest question right there. Is unless you showed evidence that all matter could sense.
I think that's right.
That would be the deepest. Ask Greg, right? If Greg's still there, but in terms of just the basic, you would say it's arbitrary to say all
matter. But it's more than that. You've got evidence that it doesn't sense. That is that there's clear difference between the behavior.
There's no reaction.
There's a clear difference between the reaction of a rock and the reaction of a plant. And
my laptop.
And it's called life. Pencil can't sense, but a plant can sense. A rock can't. It can't take action, but it.
I don't know about plants, right? But yeah, maybe.
I think
but animals, we see. Yeah.
Well, they're not conscious.
You make me think of my dog again. Anyway.
Plants are not conscious, but can you sense without consciousness? That's a good question. I don't know. What is it that the plant does when it's looking for water?
Like what? There's those Venus flytrap things, right? You know, you touch them and then they react or something.
So I don't know. Maybe even plants don't sense. But they do. They do sense, right?
That's what I'm saying. Like the Venus flytrap is an example of a plant where you touch it and it does something.
Yeah.
So would you call that sensing?
I don't know if I call it sensing. I'm not sure. So it depends on what do you mean by sense, right? Is it just a physical reaction, a physical thing?
What do we
thing?
Count as evidence for sensory?
But clearly plants are different than rocks in that they're alive. And I think that's a fundamental metaphysical difference between things that are alive and things that are not alive. And things that are not alive, part of what makes them not alive is that they don't have any sense.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So Greg says the plant is not sensing unless it's aware of it. And since plants don't have consciousness, they're not aware. So sense and awareness are connected, obviously. So, yeah. So even if plants are not sensing, suddenly non-living things are not sensing. Anyway. He says like Amiya,
photosynthesis.
No, phototropism wouldn't be sensing. So yeah, it's kind of a physical reaction. You there's some chemical response, but there's no, the plant doesn't know it needs water.
Anyway, that was my first question. Where's the evidence that it does?
Yeah.
And if you don't have any evidence,
but there's evidence to the contrary, I think. Yeah. Okay. Good. So, whereas animals, or at least some animals, have consciousness. They're conscious of their surrounding, and that's very different. And there's such a thing as consciousness, which is the sensing thing, and there's such a thing as matter. And I think consciousness and matter are two different things. They they combine together, obviously, but they're two distinct things, to the best of my understanding.
Okay. Well, thank you, Yaron. I don't know if you know your schedule, but whenever we do this next time.
I don't know if we're on for next week, aren't we?
I don't know.
I think we're on for next Tuesday.
It's kind of a monthly schedule that we make.
All right, guys. Have a great week. I'm off to see another chapter of my favorite South Korean television show, Mr. Sunshine, which if you want to get into a good mood, if you want to be inspired, if you want to actually see beauty and romance and heroism and just great heroic characters, then go watch Mr. Sunshine. It's so non-modern. It's so anti-modern. It's so anti-American TV. It's so the opposite of what was that show? Anyway, The Sopranos, any of those shows. It's so anti all that. It's about real values, real challenges, and just so beautiful. Just so beautiful. Anyway, good luck. Good luck with Boo. And maybe I'll see you next week, hopefully. And thanks, everybody. Bye.